welcome our speaker tonight. It's Eric from the Philadelphia Solution Group.
So normally I just show up half hour before the meeting start, kind of introduce myself to some of the folks that are there, thank the person who asked me to come speak, Tonight we were running late because my friend George was driving, I don't know if you have that one friend that likes to talk, operate the radio, and text while they drive. Well, that's George, right? And on top of that, he tells the worst jokes in the world, right? So I finally got a chance to put my foot on his back. And I'm like, yo, you got to speed up, bro. And he kind of zoomed up here. And it kind of reminded me of a story of a state trooper who's sitting on the side of the road. And as he's sitting on the side of the road, this car comes barreling down the highway going 120 miles per hour. State trooper automatically pulls off and he chases this car down. And as he's walking up on the car, he looks in the back seat and he sees various forms of weaponry, all sorts of knives. And he says to the guy, hey man, you were doing 120 miles an hour. Like, what's going on here? And the guy says, well, I'm sorry, officer. I didn't know I was speeding. He said, but I was running late for work and I was just trying to get to work on time. And the state trooper says to the guy, well, what's going on with all this weaponry in the back seat? He said, oh man, I juggle that stuff, man. I work in a circus. I'm a professional juggler. So the state trooper thought he was calling his bluff. He said, okay, get out and let me see you juggle some of them knives. So the guy gets out the car and he grabs about four knives from right there on the side of the highway. He began juggling the knives. He definitely was a professional juggler. At the same time, it was a meeting like this of Alcoholics Anonymous going on, and it was a smoke break, and an old timer who had been in the room for 30 years, and a guy who came in for his very first meeting walked out to have a cigarette. When he walked out to have a cigarette, they saw the state trooper and this guy juggling the knives on the side of the road. The old timer looked at the new cat and he said, hey, now's a good time to get sober. The sobriety tests are getting a bit more challenging. Good evening, everybody. My name is Eric Gibson. I'm definitely alcoholic. I'd like to thank Shay. Shay's a great girl. She asked me to come out. My husband Dave's an awesome dude. He sponsored me when I wasn't ready. but he was, I think I've had my greatest talks in Alcoholics Anonymous with that guy. I'd like to thank the group for having me out. You know, I was out here before a couple years ago, and my daughter couldn't understand why I would travel so far to talk about alcoholism. And she was like, well, Dad, it's people like right in that town. Why can't they talk about alcoholism? And I was trying to explain to her like the debt I owe to Alcoholics Anonymous and how I repay you guys. And she just couldn't get it. And then after I left, I happened to go on your website. And when I knew I was on there, I was like, hey, Shawna, you remember I went to out to Quakertown and spoke? Well, it's on the website. And, we had separation in between us for about 5 years, and during the men's process, we had established a relationship. You know, she had a son, and I was able to be a grandfather to that son, and she listened to the tape. I told her where it was at, Mom. And then later that week when she came over with her son, to my house, and they would hang out for the weekend, and she said, oh, Dad, when anybody call you just go. And I just thought that, that was one of the gifts of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I have a sobriety date, December 6, 2014. Since that date, I ain't found it necessary to use anything stronger than emotion. I have a sponsor. Just let me go through this technical stuff. I have a sponsor who knows he's my sponsor. I have a home group, the Philadelphia Solution Group, We meet on Wednesday nights in Philadelphia, the northeast section of Philadelphia, where speaker discussion meeting, but all of our speakers have experienced the 12 steps and they're sponsoring guys and they're in service and, a good group of people come out every Wednesday night. It's a little warm meeting, about 20 to 30 people. And, you know, we just have a good time. So if you're ever in the area, I encourage you to stop past and visit me and my friend George. I'm on the prison committee. I have a commitment at that home group. I think my commitment at that home group is to make sure everybody else is handling their commitments at that home group. And I think I nominated myself for that position. And, kind of works for me, you know. And I don't think that, like, I landed in Alcoholics Anonymous this time because I wanted to, or I had a plan on not drinking anymore. I don't know about you. I never once thought about not drinking during my active alcoholism or when I stopped in 2014. The only time I was stopped during those periods is if a set of circumstances kind of made me stop, like prison. You know what I mean? And, or there were times that came. It talks about fraught the emotional appeal. And I'm a firm believer in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe the program is in that book. Us being in meetings is just evidence that that book works. Some people took some actions in that book. That book worked. So it's in that book. It talks about how fraught the emotional appeal seldom suffices. I think any time that I've ever stopped, right, I was able to stop, but I was never able to stay stopped. And I think when I came to the conclusion, because there were times where I would give myself drink tests. And what that would look like would be like, I'm not as bad as I am. You know, I'm not going to drink for 5 days. And then somewhere around day 3 or 4, I would drink and say, hey, man, I could have stopped for 5 days if I wanted to. And then it just progressed to a place where I knew the situation was as bad as it was. I knew I didn't have the ability to turn it off. I knew every time I took a drink, it would be like I was getting on a roller coaster for the first time. I know it's going to be some twists and turns. I know that it might go in reverse on me. I can't see the end of it. But I better buckle up, right? Because at the end of every drink, every time I went out to drink, at the end, I didn't know where I would be, who would be hurt. I wouldn't be aware. I didn't know what the damage would be that I would cause. But, you know, towards the end, what I did was I tried to manage the damage before I drank, in my mind. And I'm going to talk about all that stuff tonight, you know, and it's my hopes that tonight we get a good look at what alcoholism looked like for me. I don't know what it looked like for everybody else, but it probably was more than like me just not being a candidate for happy hour, you know. You know, that's probably scratching the surface of what was going on with me. You know, alcoholism in my life probably looked more like me. You know, I'm the guy who gets the abandonment, right? And on trash day, I'm going furniture shopping. And I get some cool furniture, and I put it in the abandonment. And I stand in the door like a proud homeowner, and I look, and I say, this place is finally coming along. I'm sober than a judge, right? And no, it don't stop there. It gets much deeper than that, right? And then I go out front and I see that my neighbor who's been working for the city for 30 years and is really his house, he hasn't put his trash out in 2 weeks. And I feel totally justified in my anger as I'm walking up to this guy's door to knock on his door to tell him how I feel about him not putting out the trash to his house that he owns for real. You know? And the book kind of talks about that. It says that the alcoholic can't differentiate the true from the false. When I can't differentiate the true from the false, normally I'm sober, right? And when I can't differentiate the true from the false, I'm normally in a state of delusion. And one symptom of delusion is that when I'm experiencing it, I don't know it. So to you, it looks like I'm lying, but to me, it's the perfect truth. It's my reality. And that's how I move through life. I got this 5-year-old son, and his name is Jeremiah, and I'll talk about him later too. When Jeremiah was 3, we would stand in a corner, and the light would turn. This is where I'm trying. I raised him alone, and I'll tell you more about that. But when Jeremiah was 3, and we would come to the corner, this would be the place where I'd be trying to teach him the red light, green light thing, right? But at 3, you know, Jeremiah ration hasn't developed. If he was running and I stop him, say, hey, the light's red, he'd be in my hand, like, doing all kind of crazy stuff, trying to shake free as traffic's going because his ration hasn't developed, right? At 5, when we get ready to walk across the street and the light turn red, and I say, hey, the light's red, he stops. He says, sometime daddy says yes, sometime daddy says no. Daddy says no, let me just stand here. His ration has developed. My problem is, my entire life, I move through life like Jeremiah at 3. And when things don't go my way, I have this distorted ration. And when things don't go my way, I like to pack up my toys and go play somewhere else. Thank you. When I formed a relationship with alcohol, it was the answer, right? It worked from the start. I can remember having my first drink like it was yesterday, Mad Top Dog 2020. We was on a corner, and I remember drinking that stuff. It says men and women like the effect produced by alcohol. When I took that first drink of Mad Dog 2020, fear was removed. My ability to talk to other people improved. I just could do stuff. Like, I could breathe. My breathing was better. My talking was hipper. Everything. And, you know, I think from that very first drink, it was about what alcohol did for me and not to me. And, you know, people have different stories about how... Well, it was from the very first drink because I can remember tilting that bottle of Mad Dog 2020 up in the air, and after it was done, don't you know the drops that's in the bottle that you try to get on your tongue at the end? And as I was doing that, I can remember telling myself, I can't wait to do this again. But I don't know that, like, it's progressing, like, and there's a solution where it talks about we passed through a region where there's no return through human aid. I don't know along this route because, you know, where I'm from North Philly. And, like, guys are not talking about spirituality on the corner of 23rd and Burks. You know, ain't no stop signs that say, Eric, you should probably stop here and you might be okay. It talks about it being a subtle foe, an elusive enemy. Like me and my homies, we walked in, my friend Butchie had this big radio. It was the LL Cool J era. All we had to do was put batteries in the radio, make sure we had some alcohol. We like the effect that produced by alcohol, but we like anything that might intensify that effect too. So we got everything that we need, and we walk the neighborhood, and we like some real cool cats. Any corner we pull up on, everybody pull up on that corner and want to talk to us, want to dance to our music, you know. So, you know, I don't know. I know the alcohol is working for me, but I don't know that it's also progressing. I don't know if it's going to take me to a place when I start, I can't stop. And when I stop, I start again, whether I want to or not. I don't see that on the horizon. You know, I was a very skinny kid prior to what you know, contrary to what you might believe. You know, I was a very, very skinny kid, and they referred to me as JJ, one bone, stuff like that. I would get in a fight with the older guys because, you know, I always wanted to hang out with the older guys. But when you hang out with the older guys, you become the big, right? You become the guy that everybody, when they ain't got nothing to do, they start cracking jokes on you, they start body beating you. But I had this thing where I just wanted to be anything but like this young kid in the skin and the body and the mind that I was in. And then it would come to a place where, you know, I would just, anytime that I drank, I was just looking like for a deep breath somewhere in that bottle. Because, you know, I can't function, I can't talk, like, there's always 30 movies, 15 conversations, the committee is always conferring in my head. And like, you know, oftentimes I will find myself asking God to stop the world from spinning so I can get off. Because there's this whole thing out there called life, and I don't know nothing about it, and I don't want you to know that I don't know nothing about it, and I'm afraid that you might find out that I don't know nothing about it. So I'm fighting too for now, creating this actor, creating this God that I want you to believe that I am, when you really know the truth anyway. And then I reached that place where, you know, where I can no longer, you know, like when my daughter is so embarrassed of me that like she don't want nothing to do with me, or I'm continuing to think about my mother decomposing in the second floor bedroom as a result of my behavior, and I'm recognizing that, like, you know, I might be partly responsible for this. I don't know, right? But I can tell you this, when I pick up a bottle, it no longer has the ability to clench that type of thirst. And then suicide becomes extremely, extremely attractive. And every time I think about it, this sense of ease and comfort comes over my body like it's the right answer. I had these battles with delusion throughout my alcoholism. You know, the book, like I said, you know, that's one of my favorite lines in the book, that, you know, the alcoholic can't differentiate the truth from the false. And when I can't do that, I'm in a state of delusion. And normally I'm sober when I'm experiencing this delusion. It makes sense to me, even if it ain't make sense to you. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, you ever tried to explain your position to somebody else? And like, you didn't know then, but now you know you was off, and as if you was trying to explain how you felt or what you thought to somebody else, they was looking at you like you was from another planet. That's what I mean, right? I have this sister, and she's not like me, right? Although she might benefit from our program, but she's not like me. She worked for the government for 40 years. She has two kids that she raised on her own, and she did a really good job in raising them as a single parent. And like every 30 days, her and a bunch of her girlfriends, they get together, they buy all these exotic wines, and they hang out at one of their houses, and they talk about the goofy stuff that girls talk about when they hook up. On this one particular evening, my sister's coming home from one of these gatherings. She's not drunk, although she drank. Her phone falls on the floor. She's driving, went to pick up her phone. The car swerved, the state trooper saw it and pulled out right behind my little sister. When he pulled up on her, she said, "Oh, I'm sorry, I don't know what happened." He already assessed the situation. He kind of labeled her a normie. He knew he was going to let her go, but he's trying to scare her. "What are you doing? Why are you swerving like that?" He smelled alcohol. "You've been drinking. I should lock you up right now." And my sister's in that car. "Oh, no, Jesus, thank you, Jesus. Help me, Jesus, please, no. I'll do this, Jesus." And after about 5 minutes of this, the state trooper says, "Hey, I'm going to give you these keys. You're going to go home, and I better not ever catch you out here drinking and driving again." She said, "Oh, thank you, Jesus." She gets in her car and she drives home. The next month, when my sister and her girlfriends get together, my sister's going to do one of two things. She's either going to drink or she's going to drive. But she won't do both because she has the power of choice. I don't. She has ration, right? Because I have this spiritual illness, rational sound reasoning does not work for a guy like me. Hence, I'm in the car, me and my homies, right? And the bar, you know, I don't know about y'all, but, you know, when the bar closes, the party really starts, right? And we go get whatever we gonna get, and I don't know about y'all, but I'm a far better driver when I'm drunk, right? And I'm driving, and I got stuff in my hand, and I'm drinking, and I'm driving with my knee, and, you know, cause, you know, I want these guys, I know I'm a fear-driven guy. A lot of times, fear drives me my whole life, and often lands me in outcomes I'd rather avoid. And I'm driving with my knee because I got a fear that these guys won't accept me, so I'm doing cool stuff, and there goes the siren. And, like, I don't hang out with guys who keep jobs for 30 years, so as soon as the sirens go on, you hear the back doors open and feet patter. They're gone. And I pull over, and I've been doing a whole lot of drinking and a whole lot of other stuff. I'm sweating profusely, and the goal is to convince the state trooper that I'm sober. Needless to say, we have those short conversations that state troopers and I normally have, like, please get out the car and place your hands behind your back, you're under arrest. That stuff don't make me alcoholic. Right? That's just a part of my idiotic decisions, right? Period, right? But I can tell you this. I'm really not a criminal, and I know, you know, it's a life that we live forward and look backwards. For a long time, I used to carry that jacket with me because it used to make my makeup, you know. Yeah, I've been locked up 20 times. I'm the most idiotic dude you ever want to meet, right? And this is how I know I'm not a criminal. So I get arrested, and I don't know about you, like, the clock start ticking the moment I'm not fixing how I'm feeling with alcohol, right? The clock starts. I don't really have a long shelf life. And I got alcohol in my car. I got all kind of stuff hidden in my car, right? And they don't find it. They would never find it because it's my lifeline. So it's really hidden really well. And, like, I'm just been arrested for DUI. And I'm telling you, I'm not a criminal for real. I'm sitting in the cell and I'm waiting to get booked. And the longer I sit in the cell, the more my skin feels like it belongs to somebody 3 times smaller than me. And what I mean by that is start getting tight on me. My head start feeling like it got a heartbeat on both sides. Boom, 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 boom. And I need a fix. And as I'm sitting in this jail cell, I can see my car. And I know what's in it. And this is how I know I'm not a prisoner. I come up with this idea because I'm addicted to fantasy as well, right? The sober I am, the crazier I become. I come up with this idea that I'm going to slide through these jail cells and slide out that window, and I'm getting my car, and I'm going to get what's in there, and then I'm going to break back in jail, and I'm going to get back in my cell, and I'm going to try to figure out how I'm going to do this stuff without them knowing I'm doing it. So the guy gives me I'm in there for about 72 hours. It's like a setup, right? You get locked up in DUI, you're in the jail cell for 72 hours, you get out, they give you your keys and say, call somebody to come get you. Right? Okay. I'll call Uber in a minute, you know? And I get in my car, and the first thing I do is bang the corner, and I get centered because I can't really function without being centered, right? So I get my bottle, I get the deep breath that I need, and now I can think better, right? And I think most people would be like, yo, man, I ain't doing that. Let me get home. My only thinking in that moment was, not that I shouldn't do it, not that I should go home, that I shouldn't drink and drive. My only thinking in that moment is, damn, I should have took Fifth Street. So that's how I sit down and really do an inventory with this guy who's really, you know, he's really knowledgeable about the book. He had all these experiences with the book. And he sits me down and I start, you know, writing my harms done to others that I clearly understand when the book talks about selfishness. We think this is the root of our trouble, right? Because see, as I'm driving on that road with my knee and trying to impress these guys in the back seat and I'm doing all kind of stuff, on that road with me was Miss Mary. Miss Mary's husband died 2 years ago. Miss Mary wanted to die when he died. They'd been married 50 years and she felt like her life partner had gone. But every night Miss Mary works at the hospital. She goes to the hospital and what she realized was everybody brings their problems to her. She kind of helped the other employees sort their life out. So she was very beneficial to these people. So she showed up to work every night. Sometimes she showed up when she didn't even have to work. Miss Mary was on that road with me that night. On that road with me that night was Jack and Jill, right? Jack and Jill, they just got married, just bought a house. Jill just went into the hospital, right? She about to have their very first baby. They're newly married. And Jack been fixing up the baby room all weekend. And on that night that I'm on that road, Jack's gonna go pick up Jill and the baby. And guess what? They're so joyed that they're about to walk into their house as a family for the first time. And they're on that road with me. And what I've done is, I've entered them into a game of Russian roulette without their consent. That's the kind of selfishness that I kind of put out into the universe that I'm not aware of. I don't know, you know, I do, and like, I suffer from that stuff that, like, and I have that obsession, that thought that dominates all of the thoughts, like, you know, like, and that what that looks like is not like that, like, I come up with this idea that I'm a drink and that's what I own, that's the only thing I'm gonna do, you know. I can just be living life and life can be great and then the thought will come up and then I'll try to combat that thought with other thoughts like, damn, the kids is having a good time. I don't want to interrupt that. My wife's been good for 5 days. I don't want to mess that up. But for some strange reason, something takes place mentally that I can't control. And what happens is my ideas, you know, the idea of drinking sort of turns into like, Neo in the Matrix, you know, like, he'd be fighting, it'd be like 10,000 of them people and he beat them all up and he left standing. And that's what happens when I try to apply human remedies to what's going on in my mind. It just can't, right? No human power can relieve me of my alcoholism. So any idea I come up with to try to combat the idea of not drinking will fail every time for a guy like me. And, I just deal with it. And I have that thing in my body. If I, you know, when I act out on it, you know, it's Friday, my wife's not gonna be home for an hour and I go out and I act out on that obsession and I get it off and I come home and I take a shower and I put on a whole bottle of cocoa butter, hoping that she don't smell it nowhere on me. And I'm sitting there and the clock's ticking and I set that thing off. And I'm telling myself, you know, it's very clear now. That is not a thing of mental control. Because I'm not saying let's go do it. I'm saying, Eric, you better sit here or she's going to get another restraining order on you. Don't you move. Eric, you don't know what happened. You got it off. Just relax. But for some strange reason, I've got my shoes on. I'm heading out the door. And the argument with myself the whole way is, yo, turn around now. Just turn around. Just turn around, stop at the bar, do what I do. On the way home, Eric, all right, she still wanna go make a whole lot of other stops and the same stuff that happens always happens, you know. I caused my family this damage and then things are confusing in the home to the kids. And I'm on the outside and the kids are trying to wonder why the cops are telling their dad to leave. Because once I start, I can't stop. I got this thing in me that says, in my body that says, okay, my mind and body don't agree. You know, my mind can say one, and my body says, no, we're going to chase this thing. We're going to chase this thing. We're going to chase this thing until the wheels fall off. And I could never figure that out, and, you know, because I'm a smart guy, I start showing up in, like, psychiatric wards and in front of psychiatrists and therapists because there has to be something mentally wrong with me because, you know, this shouldn't be happening. I can remember, you know, I used to like to take these weekend rendezvous. I had a movement business. I had probably like 100 guys working for me, and every once in a while I would just take $10,000 and disappear for the weekend. Yeah. And on this one particular weekend, I was at this hotel, and all I could remember was waking up to like the ambulance, and I had a stroke, and the cleaning lady came and found me on the floor. And not only did I have a stroke, I had some stuff in the room that shouldn't have been there. And they kind of found that. So, like, not only am I on my way to the hospital, when I'm done with the hospital, I got to go to the police station, too. Because I'm being charged and I'm facing, like, a 4-8 because of my previous points. And the whole entire time I'm in the hospital, after having this stroke, I put my life in the hands of this neuro doctor. And I believed everything he said. I did everything he said. He was a power greater than me. I knew nothing about strokes, and he did. I entirely put my life in this guy's hands. While I'm in the hospital, my lawyer was able to get the charge. I went through the preliminary, everything, but he was able to get the charges thrown out because they weren't supposed to be searching for stuff like that. They had no business in my business, is what he said. If a stroke hits you on the left side, it affects your right side of your body. If it hits you on the right side of your brain, it affects the left side of your brain. The stroke hit me dead center in the middle where it wasn't too much damage. I'm in the hospital maybe a month or two, and what happens is the discharge day is coming, and the doctor's telling me what I need to do and what I probably shouldn't do. And when he gets to the part that, you know, after being in the hospital for these 2 months and loving this man like I loved the superhero because he was my superhero. I had the stroke. He helped me. And like after being my superhero for 2 months and, you know, and me listening to every word he said, when he got to the part where he said, you should probably stop living this lifestyle of drinking and whatever else you're doing or you could die. On my way out the door, the only thought was, man, he don't know what he's talking about. Now I'm driving. This is like 3 weeks later, out of a stroke, out of a 48. And I'm like, I got this brand new Altima. I got the sunroof back. And you know, you ever had them perfect summer days, right? Like with the wind blowing right, the birds are chirping right, the little kids playing baseball, football everywhere. Mr. Softy, oh man, you hear Mr. Softy, you know it's a good night, right? And no. And Will Smith is on your radio, summertime. It's the perfect moment. Yeah, your perfect euphoria, right? And that was me at like 3 weeks out. And I'm, man. And said the wind was blowing. I remember everything like it was yesterday. And then out of nowhere, 3 weeks out of the hospital, right? Out of a stroke, out of this jail sentence. Man, a Mike's Hard Lemonade would be good right now. Right? And then I would go to act out on that obsession drain, and I would land wherever I would land, normally prison. But see, on that day with a sober mind, I made that decision after all that stuff that had happened to me, and I came to the conclusion that a Mike's Hard Lemonade would be great. But I never had a Mike's Hard Lemonade in my life. And those are the types of delusions that I walk myself into. I don't know how I land there. I don't know. And I hope that you understand I'm normally sober than the judge when it happens, you know. And then when I get to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I spent a lot of time, you know, I went to a party when I was 13. When I came out, I was 42, right? So I spent all this time in Alcoholics Anonymous not trying to drink. Right, I spent a lot of time on sobriety, not realizing that Alcoholics Anonymous is probably about not drinking. It's probably more about waking up. Right? If I could stay woke and continue to wake up, I could hang out with y'all guys. I could run this AA race if I wanted to show other guys what it took for me to wake up and how to stay woke. Right? And I think that I'm not a rehab guy by any stretch of the means. I only go to rehab when I need the rehab to manage my relationship with the Philadelphia Probation Department. Right? That's when a guy like me lands in rehab. Right? Well, you know, the book talks about how that guy can't keep that certain appointment. That's me. My PO called me on Monday. And being on probation does not make me alcoholic. I told you that I'm an idiot who thought I was a criminal. He said on Monday, hey, Eric, I need you to come down on Friday and give me your cool. You know, you should have never let me know. Your fault. So immediately in my mind, I got 5 days. In 5 days, most people say urine can get clean, you know? You spend a lot of time in the bathroom, down in the kitchen, drinking water, right? The lemon, the vinegar. I've heard some people drink bleach. God rest their, you know, God bless them. And I had this high resolve not to drink on Monday. You know? I am guaranteeing myself on Tuesday that by Friday, I'm going to get this dude a clean urine, and I'm going to party like a rock star this weekend. Something happens in between Wednesday and Thursday I can't explain. That on Thursday, a day before I got to see this guy who got my freedom in his hands, I drink. Whether I want to or not, I have a mind that says, whether I want to or not, I'm going to do it based on my own power. And I see him, I give him this urine. The urine in the cup is hotter than the 4th of July. Trust me, you don't even got to test it, bro. And then, you know, and I'm a good guy on probation. Like, I'm probably one of them people who can qualify for being a professional probation guy. Right? I get 2 years probation in 1995. I'm still trying to get rid of that 2 years probation in 2012. And I had a lot of like violations and bids along the way being resentenced to that 2 years. And that's just how my life was prior to meeting you folks. And the judge, he puts me in front of the back judge, and the back judge is saying, you know, Mr. Gibson, this is your 10th time in front of me violating my probation. If you come again, I'm going to put you 4 to 8 up in the mountains. And while he's saying this stuff, he immediately turns and he begins to sound like the Charlie Brown teacher. Wonka, 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 wonka. Because I've already drifted away from what he's talking about to coming up with a plan on where I'm going to put my personal belongings, who am I going to ask for money, who address I need to get so I can write and get mail while I'm on the inside. Because it's not a matter of if I'm going to drink again, it's a matter of when I'm going to drink again, because I know I'm going to drink again. And I go into rehab, and in that December, I go into rehab, you know, I had a whole lot of my PO after me. I'm just a lot. I owed a lot of money, and I just checked in like I normally do. I'm in there 3 days. I don't really have a long shelf life before I'm running the rehab. And, and 3 days in, I was getting itchy, and I like tell my therapist, who was not only a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, he was a 12-step member, meaning he had experience in 12 steps. And I'm telling him, like, you know, I think I come up with the perfect lies. In December, I'm like, hey, man, I think I need to leave. My mom said I could come stay with her for the holidays, and she ain't allowed me in her house in 5 years. And he looked at me. And I kind of jabbed at him a few days with this, and then finally one day I was really pouring it on him, and he called my probation officer right while I was in front of him. And I listened to the conversation, and the conversation was sort of like this, and he said, hey, Mr. So-and-so, I think we should just let Mr. Gibson go. See, he's been here a few times, and I don't think what we have to offer will work for him. I'm coming to a place where I believe that he's therapeutically exhausted. And I'm sitting there like, what? And needless to say, my PO agreed with him, and they let me AMA. Right before I left, the probation officer said, Mr. Gibson, when you leave, I want you to go out there and run with some guys who live in that big book. I said, live in the big book? I know the big book. You don't hear me in group? I be running group all the time talking about the big book. I know that book forwards and backwards. He said, nah, you ain't hearing me. I don't want you to run with folks who know it. I want you to run with folks who live in it. And I had never heard that before. It was so foreign to me that when I left that rehab, I was thoroughly confused. I'm in Frankfurt. That's where my stomping grounds was. And while I'm in Frankfurt, I'm walking on the avenue. And I tell you, you know, as I look back, because this is a life that we live forward and review and reverse, as I look back, this would be the first time that during my active alcoholism or where I was in the midst, that like the ideas wasn't about me, the condition of my life, or what I didn't have as a result of what I was doing. It was the first time I would think about other people, and I didn't know that I was well on my way, because I'm on this walk on the avenue thinking about my mother and how she's decomposing. I'm thinking about my daughter and how she's embarrassed that, like, she got this dad who goes around the same neighborhood that she's popular in and does wild stuff. And I don't want that on them no more. I don't want my mom to continue to fall apart. I don't want my daughter to continue to be embarrassed. And I definitely don't want to drink, but I know it's coming back. I know it's only a matter of time before it happens again. And I'm on this walk, and on this walk, you know, I got this 32 in my belt, and I'm praying for the courage to pull the trigger, because in my mind, it's the right answer, and it seems like it'll solve all my problems. And like, everybody will be okay if I just can muster up the courage, and I get peaceful just thinking about it. And I can just muster up the courage to pull the trigger. But I can't. I got a plan. God got a purpose. And I didn't know that until I got inside of Alcoholics Anonymous. Think about it. We use our experience to pull people in. The stuff we've done. That prayer quickly changed to the greatest prayer I ever said in my life. God, please help me. And God don't make too hard a turn for those who seek him. So I say that prayer, and I'm the God, right? God created me. So he don't got to test me, none of that. I hear a lot of stuff just for me. I'm not saying, don't worry. He knows exactly who I am, right? And I say, you know, I'm one of them guys who prior, tell you I'm an idiot. So I put one of those dares on God. If you want me to change it, give me a sign. Because it was a win-win situation for me, right? Because if he didn't, then I can continue to pursue the idea that I was just, if God made everything, he made me this way, so I just need to play this part out of the active alcoholic and just rock out with it. But if it was something else and he wanted me to show, he all mindful, right? Thinking that he wouldn't show me, but he don't make too hard of terms with those who seek him. I was in front of Northeast Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, a place that I had frequented a lot of times trying to get sober or going in there so that that group can manage my relationship with my ex-wife when I was acting up and I'd jump up in AA. You know, I did it for all the wrong reasons. And I go inside this place, and the moment I open the door, this is 5 minutes after I say the prayer, I see this guy, Bill B. Well, and I ask him, he knows that I talk about, I see him walking across the floor, he got coffee on his shoulders, he's 3 years sober, and he's lit up. I'm not saying like he got on new joints and all that, he has a different look. Man, Bill used to run a recovery house together. And while I was drinking, Bill used to do other stuff, and in a delusional state, we was running the house, I would look over at Bill and I would say, he ain't gonna never get this, and take another pop or whatever I was doing. Well, Bill was lit up, sat me down, offered me coffee, gave me a cigarette, and on that day, I met God over a 50-cent cup of coffee in a Newport Long. And I'm forever grateful for that moment. And I would get a sponsor and I would go through this work, and I live a life behind my wildest dreams, man. I have this kid, like, and I was full of fear, you know. And I had to pick him up from the hospital. And I'm so selfish that at 2 years sober with Steph, sponsoring guys had already started 2 meetings. When I knew I had to get this kid from the hospital, my fear will drive me, and fear continues to drive me as going on 8 years sober. Fear drives me and lands me outcomes I'd rather avoid. And what I mean by that is the moment I knew that I had to get this kid, the fear that he would interrupt my lifestyle, the fear, the financial fear attached to it, had me slide into this place where I start concocting a plan in my mind. I don't know if it was a plan or a thought, but it happened. Where I can get this kid to land in the hands of DHS and know that he will be taken care of. And it never sat well with me. It goes against everything y'all taught me. Talking to my grandsponsor one day, he telling me this story. I don't remember nothing he said because I'm riddled with fear because the baby coming home in 2 days now. And I did what y'all told me to do. You know, I showed up every day after work. You know, I prayed, I meditated, I put the baby to bed, I went home, went to work, went to the, I did everything in spite of what I was thinking. Because, you know, my third step prayer, you know, says, you know, you can change the prayers, it's just make sure you voice these principles. My third step prayer is, God, please keep my feet moving because my hand will get in the way. And my grandfather tell me the story. He sound like the Charlie Brown teacher because I'm full of fear and I can't hear nothing but me. And I'm walking away, and before I walk away, he called me. He said, Eric. I said, what's up, Bob? He said, I just want you to know that the power behind you is far greater than any obstacle in front of you. And that simple statement changed my whole perspective. And Jeremiah is 5 today. He's one of the happiest kids in the world. Y'all taught me how to do that stuff. Y'all told me I couldn't go wrong if I practiced these principles in all my affairs. Jeremiah is my son, but he's also one of my affairs, right? And I practice them with this kid. And he's like, just like this happy kid. I come to Alcoholics Anonymous seeking sobriety, and I find out that y'all got freedom for me. And then sobriety becomes a byproduct of that freedom. But I don't know him. I don't know that. So I'll hook up with an experienced member. I don't know that. And the greatest gift of all is like this 12 step that we have, that like this unconditional love, this love that can't really be explained when you come in the door and I don't know you, and I want you to have everything that I have plus more, and I don't want you to give me nothing in return. I just want you to show somebody else. There's a story of this archaeologist in Ethiopia. And while he's in Ethiopia, he's doing some kind of study or something. he's having lunch and he's done lunch and he knows that like he didn't eat none of the fruit he packed. He had all this fruit left over. He noticed these two little girls playing. And, you know, Ethiopia is a very poor country. And, he says to the girls, listen, they were about 10 feet away from him. Hey, first one to get to me can have all this fruit. And he showed them, and he had an abundance of fruit. He showed it all to them and they looked. He said, I'm not trying to hurt you. I just want you to have the fruit. They looked. They said, okay. And then they set up to get ready to race. And he said, all right, you ready? And they were sisters. He said, on your mark, get set. And he put his hand down. He said, go. And the two girls stood up next to one another. They clenched hands. And they proceeded to move towards him and the fruit at the same pace so that they would arrive to him at the same time. They sat down. They began to eat the fruit. He was puzzled. He went up to the one girl and he said, yo, you're a lot smaller than your sister. You could have got here like that and you could have had all this fruit for yourself. And the little girl stood up and she said, African principal, she said, Humbunta, how can I be happy and her not? He moved away from her thinking she was the younger sister, that she didn't really understand what he was saying. And he walked over to the other sister. He said, hell, you're a lot bigger than your little sister. Like, you could have burned her and all the fruit could have been yours. And she stood up and she said the same African principle. She said, Mbunta, I exist because we exist. And I don't know that. I live in this world so alone. And I think I got to do everything for myself. And I think everything is about me. Then I link up with you guys. And y'all give me something for free. And you tell me that I can keep it and I can continue to enhance it. As long as I'm willing to share it with somebody else. And through that, I get this inexplicable, wonderful feeling that I've never got through a bottle or anything else. And I'm forever grateful for that. And I just want you to know that I exist. Because we exist. Thanks.